No wonder everybody's signing up for like position 12 or 13. It's kind of like grade inflation. Everyone is, they know that I was supposed to be number 5. Anyway. After 4 leprechauns. I come from a town called Providence, Rhode Island. And it's due to the general expansion of megalopolis cities in the United States, is now pretty much a suburb of Boston, but it can also, by some, be considered a kind of northernmost suburb of New York City. And so these three poems are just little vignettes of what I would call to be the outer periphery of New York City. Restless in front of the TV, my house is a mental treadmill. Thank God I have memories to take me through dead time. It's late at night. The city looks like a grave. They're never satisfied with the way it looks. So everything happens behind closed doors. Okay, this one is kind of my imaginary idea of a family during a flood. The air thick with fog, closer to slow rain that gets thicker as you move, is closing in on the back porch, and the air conditioner just broke. So we have to use ice in bowls behind electric fans until the flooding stops and the repair trucks are able to move. This morning, while the kids were packing, I sat cross-legged in front of the fridge to say some prayers, and I heard the sound of my own heart. Okay, and I have one more, which is about the subway. Field of weeds, palace of tall spires, girl on the subway staring straight ahead, staring intently at something in her head. Temple steps, trellis of airborne flowers, field of weeds with one crimson flower, girl on the subway staring straight ahead, with some interior private meteor or tusk of elephant patiently kept. Palace of weeds with one crimson spire. Trellis of weeds.
Thank you, Wes. Next at the open mic, we have Bree Speckley. Bree?
Elizabeth didn't have many friends. It wasn't her mind that was at fault. She got straight A's, was never lazy or impolite, and was of average attractiveness. Well, you would have to make it justice for yourself. I could describe her every teacher, and you may still say my description is inaccurate and accuse me of telling lies. But the thing that was wrong, the thing that upset the people around her, upset is the wrong word, one has to feel something for someone in order to be upset by them, and Elizabeth simply didn't have this effect upon people. But let me phrase this better. What made people uncomfortable in Elizabeth's presence was the fact that she couldn't laugh. Never a giggle, never a tinker, never a giddy snort or a raucous howl of delight. Never had the simple human sound emitted from Elizabeth's lips contorted her face or created crinkles around her eyes. Her eyes were grey. Though not unattractive, they possessed some unsettling qualities. A vacant intensity surrounded by sunken skin, and lips not dissimilar to sand that settles under a still sea. No wave of emotion ever swept over her face to disturb the smooth feel of her skin. It wasn't that her classmates disliked her. No, it wasn't that. It was more like they didn't really notice she was there. She was kind of the girl you could meet often but always forget her name. And on class excursions, Mary, the do-gooder of the class, always tried to include Elizabeth in conversation. Only after a short while, she too would invariably forget that she was in the room. But it was okay. Elizabeth didn't seem unhappy. If there had been someone there to observe her in these social situations, that someone would have to report that she never bowed her head to avoid eye contact, never fiddled with her phone or an unkempt strand of hair or occupied her fingers in cutaway stitches. There was one boy in the class that watched her, only seeing everyone else fail to notice. Perhaps it was you or me, but in retrospect, I think not. It wasn't that Elizabeth didn't feel things. She noticed the starlight sparkle of golden lamplight melting into puddles where it had not long before rained. She was curious as to how people's faces changed continually like these, much more stormy than her own, although she wasn't sure why theirs stirred so much when hers did not. Sometimes, after a long night's sleep, she would wake with a sodden pillow and, patting her cheek gently, find the moisture of tears there. This was confusing to her. She had never cried when awake, and seldom remembered the cloudy dreams which had somehow provoked the leakage of saline and germ-killing enzymes. She knew she was different, but did not understand it. And what would Elizabeth think about in the many solitary hours? Well, now, that I cannot tell you. How can you expect me to read minds? I may have created her. I may have not. Perhaps she really exists somewhere, I cannot tell. One often has a random thought and then is subsequently startled to read it thereafter in a book, or uttered by the lips of a friend or a stranger. Perhaps she is in reality shoved into her locker for a particular book as we speak. I cannot tell. I digress. I apologize. That is very unprofessional of me and some would say unethical. As I was saying, I am not quite sure what occupied Elizabeth Hope in her solitary hours. I am no mind reader. I do know of a few things she thought about, though. She told me in a dream. The boy I mentioned earlier, the boy in her class, yes, him. He had hair the colour of corn. Elizabeth thought about his hair and found that she liked to see him on breezy days when the wind swept through his hair, making it a golden sea of corn. Yes, you do not have to exchange glances with each other, really. Yes, I have stolen this image from a little prince. She also dwelled on the manner in which his face moved when he was speaking or lost in thought. She carried little videotapes in her mind of these moments, playing them back in her head in silence. The way he walked and all the noises that surrounded him and were caused by him, but were not him. The slam that reverberated through her when he closed his locker door next to hers. The squeak from his well-timed shoes when he walked down the new machine school corridor. The rise and fall of his breath. The depth of his sighs. She did not think about what she thought about him so often. She thought little on love. It simply did not occupy her. She had accepted she would not have loved in the way one accepts one's eye colour or place of birth. She did notice, however, that when on occasion his fingers brushed hers lightly by accident as he occupied himself at his locker, or when she saw him when not expecting to, she got the most peculiar of feelings. It was like a kick to the innermost region of her stomach, administered by some invisible assailant. Within all their time in class together, they had never exchanged any words except hi. Last month, the most unusual thing happened. James and Elizabeth had a conversation. The class was on a school retreat, and late in the night, when the teachers had all noisily into sleep, the schoolgirls snuck out, tiptoeing and giggling on tiptoe with hand over mouth. Mary kindly took it on herself to rouse Elizabeth, and they all settled themselves on the dewy grass outside. The boldest girl in the class was assigned to go to the boys' door to give them the all clear, and the boys followed her outside after retrieving their carefully stowed away bottle of whiskey and cans of the cheapest beer they could find in the offing with their older brother's ID. The schoolmates chattered and drank and laughed, the liquor coursing through their young veins fast and through their heads even faster. And then, well, then James got up, brushed the grass from his lap, and walked over to Elizabeth. And there it was again, that curious kick in her stomach. He looked at Elizabeth in her pale eyes, curled his fingers through hers to encourage her to rise, and said, "Can I talk to you a minute?" Elizabeth nodded coolly, and the two sat down together, a little way from the rest of the group. She could see that there was something different about his blue eyes tonight. I know, however, that he was a little bit tipsy, and that his eyes were filled with a strange intensity that a certain mood must have brought on. "Why don't you laugh?" he said. In a monotone, Elizabeth replied, "I don't know. Why do people laugh?" In response, Miss James laughed exuberantly, but didn't answer her question. Elizabeth prickled a little inside herself. Was he mocking her, she pondered? His face became more solemn. "You're beautiful, you know. I don't think you do. Such porcelain skin." He trailed off and dropped his eyes in embarrassment. Once again, he had managed to offend Elizabeth. Did he not know how much he hated it when people said that? Mary always said that when clutching at straws and making conversation with Elizabeth. She would just say, "What lovely skin you have!" And Elizabeth hated it. She hated her smooth skin. She wanted crinkles around her eyes like all the others. Still, her face remained the same, though she crinkled in her stomach. She did not reply. James was looking down now. His brow was knitted, and he seemed to be looking for the missing stitch in the grass. He found some courage and instead, "Elizabeth, the reason I wanted to talk to you tonight is, well, you see, I like you. Elizabeth said nothing, but that's the most peculiar rising feeling, right, rising up in her throat. It tickles. Are you going to say something? Do you like me to? I see you looking at me sometimes. Still composed, to replied calmly. But you don't know me. And the tickling rose a little higher in her throat. James took in with a nervous smile. Maybe I don't know you, but I think I want to. They say that most of communication is nonverbal anyway. Everyone's always saying so much all the time, with their arms, with their eyes, with their walk. It's so loud, it's deafening. It makes me want to scream sometimes, but you say nothing. And I want to know what you're saying inside. The tickling grew and grew in Elizabeth's throat, growing more and more unbearable with each of James' words. It grew and it grew until she could stand it no longer. And then Elizabeth laughed. It was the loudest, strangest laugh I've ever heard, and came completely to her own and changed with disbelief. She looked at Elizabeth and down in confusion and once more at her contorting face. And she laughed, and she laughed, and she laughed. The mortification on James' face was replaced with anger. You don't have to be so cruelly fast. And rose sharply to return to the others. And Elizabeth, she remained where she was, and laughed for an hour or more until she eventually laughed herself to sleep. And Mary roused her when it was time to return to their bed. Elizabeth laughed all the time now. Quite strange. The other evening she laughed at a beautiful sunset. She cried now too, not only when she was asleep. Her mother found her just last night staring at a flower in their garden, tears flowing freely from her face and dropping like dew onto the rose petals. I think she's still at school. The teachers and the mothers are a little worried about her. James and Elizabeth don't say hi anymore. Anytime their eyes meet, James looks away with ferocious embarrassment. But when he's not looking, Elizabeth still admires his golden hair. And when she's not looking, James examines the newly formed crinkles around Elizabeth's eyes. Her eyes seem less grey now, more blue than they used to be somehow. Some would say she is more beautiful, some would say that she is less so. Mary still comments on Elizabeth's smooth skin, though she doesn't mean it anymore. She just doesn't know what to speak about, nor do I anymore, so I will end my tale here.
Thank you, Luke. Next up we have Patricia Roth.
Thank you, Paul. Can you hear me? That? This one is called the Intervenor Table. Look me in the face and see if I mind which way your attitude is designed. Be good and true and confidently, but one's mind to part rudimentary of passion and thought above the standard which in lesser age I would have handed. Look and see how top of steps back to lead from zero, as you have attained 6 or 7 months before, the sooner to get wife and the hell there are bread. To connect the function, to score off the icing, the bright and heavy cable to the drain, and switch the mind to what surprises away from names I shall retain. My own is the reason for some disgrace. Of others everywhere, on your sick of hearing, this I will paper and think without trace, from chance of love, I see it and hearing. Circumstances bound, I never take it, but you force me to swallow in the right frame of mind. And though we happen to take it, I know the way why your ashes are designed.
Thank you, Patricia. And next up we have Seamus Harrington.
Rough greeting. A decadent man in his day, he now contemplates in rough grade, and each naval crease means literal peace, this mystic has nothing to say. This one's for Matthew. Catacombs. Catechismic screen of brakes. All cyclists without line and toe racing into the orange shoe glimmer. Frozen in a sacred act on the roadway. Mitre ears. Wide eyes. Froze your tails. Diverse feline congregation. Pine needles hang fused with fresh clay. A common hissing explosion of fork. Flash of onyx. Two devilish tongues dive for bunker cover behind the convivial cannon's headstone in the dead of night. Pegasus. Parts merge to enchant. Then Zeus, he is gone. In one lightning bolt, blowtorched sheet metal. Pre-dawn, I'll return to spot stars on its flanks. Hippocrene shod, wings brushing through north. Beachcombers. Abandoned tip, abandoned ship, no time to tip out any jetsam. Demon hexes, no affixes, many boxes flipping into flotsam. As mentioned in dispatches, nature pulls no punches, one too many trenches in these western approaches. I will allow my bulbous bow is dipping now and then, the bitter pill, that saline fill, pumps are still again. Water from the outside, pouring in a flood, damming all my insides, always knew it could. Compass truly is pointless, landfall off the bow, every life is priceless, you've life raft to install. Engine hush, decks awash through misadventure, not so posh beneath the cosh of deepest winter. Toast to tow, but where to go, my schedule is in tatters. Course is clear, okay, you steer, I'm holes below the water. Now the high side is my port side, above the seas and core. Tons go overboard to starboard, I'm not keeping score. Withstanding every broadside, cargo tumbling off, smashing on the flood tide against the broken cliff. Insecticide is specified in my manifesto. Motorbikes for free, seized upon with gusto. Now that's not yours, too late the ruddy gaffer. Behind closed doors, those who beg to differ. From Lion Bay to eBay, everything's for sale. Battery acid, wine barrels, nappies by the bale. Although well found, I'm hard the ground against my will. Repeating seas with taunting ease pounds against my hull. Fungicide, the headlines cried, a story here at last. They represent a perfume scent for years before the mast. Through every pore I feel the shore, so near my rudder stock. When light again, I fight again for survey and dry dock. A buoyant whim, an even trim, someday when tides are slack, I leave this cove a treasure trove and bid you each good luck. Thank you.
Great. 25 past 11. 26 minutes past 11 right now. What time is this?
This first one is a farewell to Germany. I was living there for 3 months until the end of May. and four times previous to that over the last 5 years. I'm there for the World Cup final. Really stoked the city up, fantastic city. Last time, the flat downstairs for me was empty. Every day I went down the stairs, I saw the name Heckewald on the door. Heckewald in German means a hedge, a forest of hedges. And this poem I've written slowly over the last month. Heckewald. Heckewald is tot. Heckewald is dead. No more to build on there. His compact flat lies empty. The door unbrushed, unwashed. The sheets on the bed just as he left them. The drained beer bottles piled up waiting to be brought back to redeem their fat. And new full bottles bought in their stead. No, Heckewald is done with beer drinking. Heckewald is finished watching Germany fight its way at the World Cup finals. With a flag-waving card blowing horns all the way down Hauptstrasse and girls in hot pants dancing outside the pub. Heckewald will eat no more currywurst as he rushes to the U-Bahn in the morning. He will sit no longer in front of the screen in the internet cafe, throwing up picture after picture of women he might meet. He will not shout again at bus drivers who take off as he reaches his stop. Where has he vanished to, Heckewald? Has someone knifed him in Neukölln as he waited on the night bus home? Or has he been caught up in a bombing? He always had a finger in the uprising that never happened. He wanted so much. What am I to do with the mail that's come, most of it from Austria? Or the boy with the dog that keeps ringing his bell? Will the landlord start believing me? Should I put an ad in Tagesspiegel saying Heckewald is dead, Heckewald is tot? My father died at the end of April 2007, and the year to the day after he died, I was doing a reading in Leipzig, and this poem started coming to me, and I got this creepy feeling my father was saying the poem to me. In the garden, in memory of my father. While I was shawling the strawberries with fine green netting, you told me about the cow that swam to the island to stand there mooing until the seals came in close to add their own belling, with the seagulls circling above, cow-cowing. And after you'd stared enough, you ran to the farmer who didn't believe until he saw for himself, then asked if you'd row him out there to ferry the creature home. And you wouldn't, saying it was too heavy, would sink the boat, or at least would kick out, sending all three of you overboard. No, the Narran lifeboat had to be called to bring the cow back to a cheering crowd. I stood there visualizing the whole film as you spaded the bright new potato. And I'll finish with a little thing that I wrote and done about last week. We have big problems in Donegal with mice. Except I think they're all rats. A huge mouse. A huge mouse came bounding up the road. Its teeth were the size of tombstones. Its tail was the rope used to tug the Titanic out in the cold harbor. Its moon-sized eyes were devouring me, or telling me its cave mouth would do that quicker than a lion might gobble a gazelle. I looked up at the peak of Binion Hill, willingness of up there, and yet a Messerschmitt-sized seagull's beak clamped my belt at the back of my spine and dumped me on the hilltop's cairn while a deafening squeak passed over me to die out far away on the Isle of Skye.
Thank you. It's also a great pleasure to call up our next poet, who will hopefully be with us next week and the week after and the one after that, Mr. Alan Tippy.
Thanks, Paul. It's actually poetry tonight, not stories. We're back to translations that I've done. And this is a translation from some Scottish poetry from the great Scottish poet, Scottish Gaelic poet, Sáraí McLean. And I'm going to show off because I'm going to read it in Scottish Gaelic first. I've seen it, probably nobody else here can speak it. If I screw it up, nobody will never know. And then I'll read the English in it anyway, but it's okay. It's called Calvary. Hanel mhuil ar Calvary, nuar Bethlehem an oi, ach ar cúil ach rodin gafachu, par a bel an lau a fáis. Ach ar siomar an dunedin, siomar bochgin a croig, par a bel an nui an cuechtach, vi un a greit gavos. My eye is not in Calvary, or the Bethlehem of straw, but on a dirty room in Glasgow, where rottenness is all. And in a hovel in Edinburgh, a hole of filth and flies, where the stinking, weakling baby pukes up before it dies. He had his he's only really just a few very short ones, the four lines, so you don't have to clap after everyone, or you get very tired. Matthew was talking about the Isle of Skye. There's a castle in the Isle of Skye, Dunsegan Castle, was owned by the MacLeods, who were rotten landlords. Well, that was what I was saying. Or rotten. And when he tried to dispossess his people in the 19th century, they rose up and tried to burn his house, which he didn't succeed in doing, but he succeeded in burning there. So Sáraí McLean again wrote a very pithy four-line poem, which I simply translated as Castle Burning. Though they nearly burned Dunvegan Castle from head to heel, MacLeod's burning his tenant houses was entirely real. And one by another Scottish poet, Ian Crichton Smith, again a translation of the Gaelic, called The Old Saws or The Old Proverbs. The proverbs sallied away beyond upon the briny sea until they reached a brown sailed town unknowable to me. And one or two from Old Irish, four lines as well. This is to lower the tone entirely, called Hafting. It's been translated before, but this translation's better. We know her well, her tricks, her turns, her arts, her belching catapults come straight from the heart. And I'll just do maybe one more. Okay, this is also from the Old Irish. They're all dead, so they can't do this. Whether to prefer the tolling bell of a frightened church on a stormy night, or the wild howlings of a passionate woman, is the only choice.
Thank you, Alan. Okay, we've got seven poets left. We've got just over 20 minutes, so we've got to keep it to 3 minutes each. Otherwise, we're going to get kicked out. And believe me, we'll get kicked out. Because your man downstairs is like a demon. So I'm not going to steal the time. And next up we have Mr. Martin Harriott.
This one is called Touching the Earth. Today in the West Cork. And I know W.B. Yeats is going to come back and haunt me and give out me endlessly in sonorous tones for it. They left the urban scene and went to Keelanee, to a timber cabin there of dark stained pine logs made. Nine earth rows they dig and sow, hives for the vanishing bees. Oak and ash they have planted in the high beach bay. Encircled by the bluebells and the white thorn of May, now they feel well grounded, an earthy change of gold. Dark crumbly compost enriches the stony clay, Verdant bean shoots twine tendrils on hazel poles. They find some peace there, peace that speaks in flow, through cobweb dew of morning where the skylark sings. The bog at night is silvered and the gorse at noon aglow, and dusk is often full of sleet swallowed wings. Far from the frantic crowd always night and day, they hear stream water gurgle through the mossy rocks. When they're in the city or on the motorway, in the mind's ear the curlew's cry and the lone call of the fox. They go to farmers' markets for their tasty natural food, and chop up dead wood for the stove while devil oil runs dry. And though they curse the drizzle, it's part of nature's moods, and nights might bring a thousand stars in the dark velvet sky. Just hearing Alan Pitley's translation, it just reminded me of one that I didn't translate, but I just cheated and put into my little book of poems. But I do acknowledge there wasn't me who wrote it. Ye who indulge, this is from the old monks in Ireland. Ye who indulge in drink and gambling, and all the pleasures from table to bed, if the promise of heaven applies to ye, then sadly are the friars misled.
Next up, we have, for the first time, hopefully not to last, Mr. Graham Allen.
Okay, well, what to choose? So this one I chose because I've given up, this is stage 51, I've given up smoking. And people have been saying to me, you must be feeling so great, and I've been saying, well, you know, what I would do if I wasn't drinking like a fish. But this is about, this is about me and my father, and as you can see, I can now say the first line in a different way. This was written about 3 years ago. It's called The Fags. I don't quite know why. One day I will give up smoking. One day before it becomes too late, and I've lost my chance to be my father, emerging as if by magic out of a rush hour crowd of commuters at Liverpool Street Station on a Friday afternoon at the peak of summer. His shirt collar open, his jacket slung across his shoulder, his grin like a celebrity's greeting, the sun pouring out of his eyes, the hero of a thousand well-told stories, a year or two before final retirement, looking like a man anyone would marry, carrying his Tory grass, the cross words finished, under his free left arm, a baton for that truncheon he returned and that I coveted as a relic. Blithe escapee from a thousand close shades, freedom in his face and mischief in his eyes, Israel an island shooting through his mind as he cuts through the crush like parted waves, Moses incognito within the promised land, and mistakes me, his own Telemachus, for an obstacle in his singular career.
One more. And this is, well, so topicality. One, given up smoking. Second, we're going to see this guy on Thursday. I'm actually really looking forward to it. The Bowl with Morrissey. So this is one of the greatest Anglo-Irish poets since the war. What war? I don't know.
The lyrics are in the Guardian today.
This is called Much More Than This. Everything in this poem happened, including the gift to my mother at the end of the poem, which, you know, I'm going to have to tell you it happened, because you wouldn't believe someone as apparently intelligent as me could do such a stupid thing. Okay, so this is a long time ago. This is called Much More Than This.
That Christmas, my life seems to be speeding up. How many events can you cram into a weekend? Both of them not only there to greet me, two drinks at Victoria Coach Station, Bart's birthday surprise, free tickets for the evening, the Smiths of the Electric Ballroom Camden, our band, our style, our mode of irony. Having been self-conscious for more than a year, we knew precisely what he thought he was at. The epoch of the rain-coated geek had arrived. This was our time, we were cruising. I sometimes look back and wonder if I didn't leave that ace of grass as a booby trap, purchased from a Sinn Féin boy named Fergal, and smuggled into London to detonate the peace. What was in many ways the best night of my life skidded into a fallout blown by morning. I was trying to blow myself up in their eyes, trying to die into independence. I couldn't quite bring the whole thing off. Found myself locked inside a Morrissey dog. What was I thinking? My mother's religious fury. My father, an agent of the law, still needing their donations for the final push into the realm of poetry, state grants and freedom. So I bought them a classy wooden jewellery box from a market stall in Covent Garden. Spent the whole vacation drinking money on an indulgence, a momentous potlatch. As she opened the lid on Christmas Day, I watched her face collapse like glass, and too late became conscious of the fact that the metallic tune it played was my way.
Thank you, Brian. Next up we have Marta Montezari.
So this is a recipe. Add two eggs and blend. Beautiful, interesting, devoted, balanced, delicately resilient, perfect but low maintenance, tender but tough, passionate, socially appropriate, independently needy, skinny but with curves, reasonably large breasts, articulate but not domineering, intelligent, but not overwhelmingly so. Timid, but daring. A good mother, able to knit, provides 48.5% of the total income. A good cook. Across the table, your muffin cup hangs over your mother's outdated fashion sense. Your hairline receding, your beard is patchy, and your glasses balanced over your cigarette ear. A soft banassi pie into both cheeks and wonder if steady cracker may manage to put this recipe into a box.
Thank you, Martha. Next up we have Gordon Pirandi.
Time is of the essence, so I'm just going to do this called Waking from the Dream She Visited. My eyes opened. I gained the whole world and lost.
That was depressing. But somehow there was hope in there.
That was a day to
Next up, could we welcome Mary Ann. Hey.
Hi.
the poem was set in Berlin at the zoo. He took me mainly to places of leave taking. Bahnhof Grunewald, Auschwitz, Belsen. The grave of Heinrich von Kleist at the Wannsee. And airy galleries hung only with paintings of death. Pulled me running through the tunnels of the S-Bahn as if our lives depended on some eastbound train we were about to miss. But we had our haunt, the aquarium, where we spent hours, days, pressing our faces against the icy violet jellyfish gliding on their eddies and backdrafts, their silken root threads quivering to pulse waves, pulling against the vortex. We would clasp each other's cold fingers then, I the hybrid lines of the zoo, feather-toed hens, dwarf donkeys, kangaroos, rats, and dream a stampede of roaring ghost animals in the pier garden on the run from the trains. The trees in the zoo's park were still frozen in their early bud, pushing small flowers into air full of the mewling of unseen birds. Snowflakes falling on the spray were tiny gulls. We took the yellow U-Bahn home, its bulbs rocking, pale petals fluttering in the arc of its headlights. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. And next up, we have David Cotter.
I could not see the forest for the field of wheat, white out in the sudden cold. Reaching out to snap an icy stalk, I touched instead a tree trunk falling. Bending down to candles on a frosted cake, a raging forest fire rushed to my skin with fierce flames of affection, friendship, recognition. Trailing on a window, a single wavering drop, a drift of snow swept over, pulled under. A sheet of tissue scarred the face and left the landscape altered. I could not gauge your forest, for the broken trees glimpsed, not glimpsed, with all beneath the fall of silence, and were lovely forests if I could see. And this one's called Horizons, is written at the He knocks me on the quayside, for my own good, he says, and the safety of dockers everywhere. He leaves me sprawled in oily water beneath the seagulls circling and those great steel arms swinging, reaching, testing, lifting effortlessly above me the blue sky. And struck again, I could have been a crane driver.
Thank you, David. And before we call it an evening, we have one last poet, our ex-bartender. For the first time, free to express himself as a normal person. Shane McGarty.
Yay! I was actually going to read Marcy thing from the lyrics today because I'm going to see him on Thursday and I don't know the music, but I was amazed at the lyrics today. But I decided no, I just keep to my TV self, and I wrote this while I was sitting there about a story that happened to me today. So I am a girl. I don't have many precious things that I hold dear, but one collection belonging to me was nearly taken off and the prospect filled me with fear. Now, I'm no terrorist, don't get my actions through, but some must have their doubts after the ordeal I just went through. As a dutiful traveller going through the airport, I kept to the security room. I used the plastic bags that were provided in place by non-clothing tools. They waved me all in court and I went on my way. However, they weren't so lenient and standstill when I returned back today. They took me aside. I felt guilty, but I had done nothing wrong, and threw my bags that began to tear. Taking all my clothes out was bad enough, but then the security man began to shuffle through my underwear. But that was not the problem. It was my makeup collection, of which I take pride, was flipped through, looked at with disdain, and then taken aside. My heart sank, my eyes watered, and I began to plead, "Jesus, you can take anything you want, but don't take my makeup away from me." I was close to missing my flight, but that was not my priority. My companion told me to calm down and was surprised at my dismay. But my reply was, "Dude, I'm a girl. It's makeup, my disguise. That's just the way." Thank God they gave it back to me. I got my flight and my makeup was intact. Yes, I'm shallow. Yes, I need it. Yes, I spend way too much on it. But I'm a girl. I love makeup and that's a fact.
Thank you, Celine. So before we end the evening and go up to the crane lane, as we usually do, there's this poem I've been trying to flog to death for the last year. It's an amusing aftertaste. This river of kingly colour, an ocular delight, this stream of pure poesy, a vain aortic mixture of spirit liquid. It's even evolved vampires overdose on blends, rich blends, of thick contradiction, of unraveled breath, expires, and even as muses, pilgrim seasoned muses, each leave a trail of purple dripping from tongue and teeth, and even as poets, star poets, sip the mountain manna purple poem wine, dream drunk poets, pulse deafened, descend purply, their seasoned lips. Thank you very much. Thank you for our guest, Ethan Cassidy, Leslie Joy. Thank you for coming up.